is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome the author, Marilyn Brookwood. The new book is The Orphans of Davenport. This is the story of eugenics, the Great Depression, and the war over children's intelligence. Here in the 21st century, it is commonsensical that a loving family is critical to the development of a child to adulthood. Marilyn Brookwood is a psychologist. She's worked in public education and adjunct faculty position at the College of New Rochelle. Writing this book from the documents assembled over the last 100 years from heroic work at the University of Iowa, we begin with one of those heroes at the University of Iowa in the 1930s during the depths of the Depression. Iowa went from being the fourth wealthiest state to poverty as all farming prices collapsed with the dislocation of the weather, the climate, and worldwide affairs. In Chicago, at the American Association on Mental Deficiency, 1939, a man takes to the podium in the fourth day. It's unseasonably hot. This is Maryland's reporting. His name is Harold Skeels. He's a professor. He's a doctor. He's a psychologist. Marilyn, congratulations and a very good evening to you. Who is Harold Skeels that day? What is he presenting and what opposition does he face? Good day to you.
Thank you and my appreciation for your interest in my book. So Harold was a conventionally trained animal expert in animal husbandry when, for reasons we don't understand, he took himself to the Iowa station and began to do research on children's intelligence. He began by thinking that children really had the same intelligence as their parents, just as everybody else thought in that time. And as he did his research, he stumbled on very, very surprising results. His first surprise was testing the intelligence of children in the Davenport orphanage and discovering two children who were 13 months and 16 months old who had extremely low intelligence. And he realized immediately he was going to have to place them in an institution for the very lowest intelligence groups, and they would remain there for the rest of their lives. So he tried to do that, and no, it was so crowded, all of the Iowa's institutions were so crowded, that he wound up accepting a very unusual offer to place them with women who had been, who had low intelligence, who had been placed in that institution. They were called morons, and this was eugenic time, so that was perfectly acceptable in almost all states in the United States. And so those two little girls were sent to this institution. How did Harold know how that they had such low intelligence in the first place? He did it by looking at milestones. There really weren't then any kinds of tests, formal tests, but he had seen hundreds of little children, and he could see that they didn't do the things that little children normal their ages normally did. They didn't try to stand up. They didn't try to speak. They didn't follow you with their eyes. They weren't deaf, but they didn't respond to sound. So that and many other qualifications, he thought that they were in the categories of imbeciles, which was then a formal category in intelligence. And he sent them to go to another institution called the Woodward School for the Epileptic and for other children who were had low intelligence, but who were medical cases. So those two little girls arrive, and they each one of them is placed in a ward with adults, women, who had intelligence that was extremely low and who were between the ages of 9 and 15. And the women had, you know, no one took much very good care of them, although it was better than in Davenport. And they loved these little girls. They suddenly saw a place for themselves, and they started to care for them. So they took them around. They showed them the school. They talked to them incessantly. They taught them to walk. They taught them to be toilet trained. They sang to them. They showed them pictures. Their families might have sent them money, and they asked the staff to buy gifts for them. And the children responded so remarkably to this care that after 6 to 7 months had passed, the children, these two little girls, became almost normal. One day, Harold Skeels, making a regular visit to Woodward School, not to see these little girls, he didn't even remember they were there, with a colleague of his, Maurice Kodak, walks into the main hall, and he sees these two little normal-appearing girls, little toddlers, playing, and he wonders why they're even there. And he asks who they are. Someone tells him, these are the two little girls you sent us from Davenport. He almost didn't believe it. So the next day, he tested their intelligence. And when he did that, he found BD was almost normal in intelligence, and CD was getting there. Her intelligence had come up a great deal, but she wasn't quite normal. And he was so stunned by this that he decided he wanted to observe them for a year. He didn't move in, but every couple of months he would go from Davenport to Woodward, and he would look at these girls and give them more IQ tests. And he saw their IQs advancing and advancing.
And this is what this is what Harold presented to the meeting in Chicago. I want to frame these details. And I want to say, in the room, he's not being applauded. He's being refuted in people's faces. They're frowning at him. In fact, they've already called his presentation moron nursemaid study. Who is the opposition in the room that day, Marilyn? What do they call themselves?
No one really wanted to believe that Harold could be right, or that the people in Iowa could be right about this. They thought this research was tainted in some way. And the people who were in the room were eugenicists. Most of America's psychologists in that time were eugenics, were believers in eugenics. The leader of the group that attacked Harold was not present. His name was Lewis Terman. And Lewis Terman was the head of the psychology department at Stanford University, a very prestigious position. And Lewis Terman was one of the leading eugenicists in America.
His allies were in the room, however, and they all knew that Harold Skeels would be there. I want to go several months later to frame the seriousness of the opposition. This is 1939, spring of 1939. We now go to the winter of 1940. Everybody knows what's going on right now. The world's at war in Europe, and it's about to be a war that the U.S. is drawn into. However, children are being abused. Adults are being abused. The world is at war. But in February of 1940, the director of the Iowa station, this is the University of Iowa, it has a school attached to it, and it studies children's psychology. His name is George Stoddard. He climbs the steps in St. Louis, making a presentation to a similar association. You report that they attacked him ferociously. They were waiting for him. What did they fear? Why were they attacking Stoddard so quickly? And then we'll turn to what eugenics is. Why that day?
So Stoddard, I would say Stoddard wasn't attacked ferociously, but they were waiting to attack him. And Stoddard had hoped at this meeting, which was a national meeting of psychologists from all over, who none of whom really knew in detail about the Iowa work. It wasn't like today when people can read these things on the internet. So Stoddard was looking forward to an opportunity to present the Iowa work. But Dr. Terman had made sure that didn't happen. And the Iowa, most important Iowa papers were not presented. And Dr. Terman also made sure that a paper that should have been presented, that one of his colleagues had written and would have given the Iowa people an opportunity to refute the criticisms of the Iowa work, that paper also was kept out of the discussion. I won't go into why, but it's all in the book. And so George Stoddard was waiting for a ferocious attack. The actual attack didn't come in the way he thought. It came later. But the people who were there went home and read some material that Terman had sent out, and Terman's another colleague of Terman's, Quinn McNamara, had published. And after that, no one believed the Iowa work. You know, these Iowa people came from a little university that didn't have a lot of prestige. And here were these very prestigious psychologists from all over the country saying, no, this can't really be happening.
They were denying common sense in the 21st century. So let's turn to, who are these eugenicists? Where do they come from? What is an IQ test in the early part of the 20th century? And how was it used and distorted in human history? The Orphans of Davenport is the book. This is the story of eugenics, the Great Depression, and the war over children's intelligence. Marilyn Brookwood is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Marilyn Brookwood, the author of the new book, The Orphans of Davenport, Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. The controversy in the early part of the 20th century has to do with our children born with the intelligence they'll have their whole lives. And is it important that who their parents are, if their parents are socially unacceptable, does that mean they have low intelligence? What does it mean for child rearing? We go now to a school called eugenics. Eugenicists are present at the presentation by Harold Skeels and the presentation by George Stoddard. Eugenics begins, however, in the 19th century, a man named Francis Galton. Marilyn, who is Francis Galton, and what did he intend by inventing the science or the observation or the cult of eugenics?
Francis Galton is a cousin of Charles Darwin's. And he listened to Darwin's ideas about how evolution changes the species. And he extrapolated from Darwin's information an idea that children inherit from their parents as single traits, things like pauperism, sense of humor, criminality, promiscuity, and so on. And Galton put these ideas out into the English intellectual atmosphere, and they were very much believed. He thought that it would be possible to create a society of the able if you kept people with those poor traits from reproducing. And he tried to do that by encouraging people like himself and other prominent people to have more children. Interestingly, Galton didn't have any children, but it didn't really do the trick. And even though he tried to put through some laws for institutionalizing people with poor traits through Parliament, Parliament would not do that for him. Galton died before he saw that his ideas jumped the pond and became institutionalized in the United States in a period around the turn of the century, when between 1880 and 1920, about 20 million immigrants arrived in the U.S. And there grew up an objection to these immigrants because they did not meet the standards of intelligence and culture that the United States saw in its future. So they would test immigrants' intelligence. And of course, the immigrants didn't speak much English, so they didn't do very well on the test. Where did they get these tests? In 1916, Lewis Terman had published something he'd been working on for a long time, which was an IQ test. When he started working on this IQ test, he borrowed it from a French psychologist named Binet, but Terman took the test and changed it significantly from what Alfred Binet intended. So Terman said absolutely out in front of the public that he designed this test in order to have an instrument that would decide who should be institutionalized, because to have those people reproducing and having children was dangerous to the
American. In other words, eugenics is their theory of improving, and dysgenics is their theory of damaging the so-called race. These are inexact words that were used 100 years ago, but the language has changed profoundly. We have to be careful. There are other academics who enter into this. However, the IQ test is given to the doughboys who go off to the first war, and it's seen as determinative. I need to go to how it becomes quickly distorted. A man by the name of Laughlin from Iowa, he's a horse trainer. He's a horse breeder. But he's adopted by the eugenicists and constructs a school, and whereby he can visit his prejudices against all children from the wrong place, or the wrong race, or the wrong country. Striking to me, Marilyn, is that he's a secret epileptic. And I noted in several of the institutions, they combine epilepsy with feeble-mindedness. And Charles Laughlin, today, I mean, all of a sudden, it like solved the crime, because the man becomes someone whose information is used by the worst people on the planet. And he was a secret epileptic.
That's right. So Laughlin worked at Cold Spring Harbor Lab at the Eugenics Records Office in the early part of the century. And he became the expert in the United States on sterilization and institutionalization of people with what he considered dysgenic traits. He was a eugenicist. And the use of the word dysgenic was really an adjective to describe these kinds of traits that were endangering society. And Laughlin was called before the Congress, and he was very influential in the passage of the 1924 Johnson-Reed legislation that limited who could come into the United States.
All right, let's turn back to our heroes, Marilyn. Enough time with the villains here. The book is The Orphans of Davenport, Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. We know way too much about the bad side of eugenics. What we need to learn is how eugenics was smashed by the smart people at Iowa. Marilyn Brookwood is the author. This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Bashir.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Marilyn Brookwood is the author of The Orphans of Davenport, Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. We go now to our heroes, Harold Skeels, his colleague, Marie Skodak, who becomes a Ph.D. student in Iowa in the mid-1930s. Their director, George Stoddard. We mentioned Beth Wellman, though we don't have time to tell the story. But this was a supportive atmosphere at the University of Iowa. Davenport is an orphanage that was established philanthropically at the end of the Civil War for orphans, for children of deceased or damaged Civil War veterans. It becomes by 1900 a place where they take in orphans from all over Iowa and put them up for adoption. Harold Skeels and Marie Skodak, with the car that's provided to them, take upon themselves to visit the families who've adopted children over the years to see if there's been a change in the children. And they travel all over in the winter of 35 and in the spring of 35. And Marilyn, these case studies are gripping because what they expect to find and what they do find are completely different. I love the scene that you paint where the adoptive parents hang back out of the room as Marie Skodak and Harold Skeel sit down with these small children. They can be 3 years or 4 years old. And the parents are extremely worried that they'll be judged not worthy and taken back to Davenport or put into Glenwood for the home for the feeble-minded. What is the test that they give to children this young? Is it the same IQ test that Terman invented, or is it their own version, Marilyn?
What they're doing, it's not a Terman test. What they've done, because they know so children of this age so well, is put together some kinds of questions and things for children to do. Can you, if I tell you to put the spoon in the cup and stir it, can you do that? If I tell you to draw a circle, can you do that? If I tell you to tell me, what does this word mean? Can you do that? And so they have these tests they're giving to these children. They're driving everywhere in Iowa because the state of Iowa won't approve the adoptions unless the children are actually of normal intelligence. Any child who was not of normal intelligence had to be placed into a special institution, and they would have had to withdraw these children from the homes, that the only homes they had ever known, and take them and put away right then and put them in other institutions. So it was something they were dreading, but they knew normal children, and they used some of Terman's ideas, but Terman's test really was not considered valid until you were about 6 years old. And these children were about a year and a half to 2 years of age. So they had over 4 years, they tested 600 of these children adopted from Davenport. Every one of these children had poor heredity. Every one of the children had a parent or two parents of extremely low intelligence. And they expected that these little babies that had been adopted at 15 months or 20 months, when they were now going to see them, would show the results of that very poor intelligence. And they were absolutely amazed to find that of the 600 children they looked at, 600, imagine, over 4 years, they only took two who were intellectually deficient, and they had to remove them. So, and not only were the children normal, but they had IQs that today are considered in the superior range. So Harold Skeels described those children as having the same kinds of IQs as the children of university professors.
All right. Harold takes that learning of accidental learning, and they're now about to have an experiment. 11 children are taken out of Davenport, and then there are children in the control group left at Davenport. 3 boys and 8 girls are my notes, and they're put into environments to observe them. This is 1936, to observe their improvement. What do they determine from that experiment that Harold is running?
So those children were retarded, and they had come into Davenport, most of them as normal children, and while being mistreated at Davenport and neglected, they became retarded, and they were then sent to live with other women. If it worked with B, D, and C, D, maybe it would work with these children. Harold didn't know that, but he got permission to do it. So he takes them and brings them to Glenwood. And guess what? The same thing that happened to BD and CD, and the same thing that happened to the other children, these children also became normal. And so Harold was really encouraged, and so were the people he worked with, his colleagues at the Iowa station, were very encouraged. And they realized that they had almost accidentally come upon research, their own research, that challenged everything that America's psychologists were teaching and believed. And by the way, everyone except George Stoddard, but every other person there who was a psychologist had believed that the ideas of eugenics were correct. And now they had evidence that they weren't correct. So it was really revolutionary.
Environmentalists versus hereditarians. It is now 1961. Harold Skills has risen in the world. He's at the National Institute of Mental Health. And Maurice Kodak is working, I believe, in Dearborn, Michigan.
That's right.
Dearborn, Michigan. But they have occasion, they have a grant to go and interview the same case studies that of those 11 and others who are now late 20s, early 30s. They're visiting the same people, and nobody's ever followed up before, and the revelations are obvious. Again and again, Marilyn, what we're finding here is something that we regard as commonsensical in the 21st century, but it would have been surprising that people continued to develop comfortably. What did they find about CD and BD in 1961?
So the first child, Harold went to see, he wanted to see the parents to get permission to see the now adult children. This was a different time than today. And he found out that BD and CD's parents, adoptive parents, had died while she was an adolescent, and an aunt had raised her. And it was not perhaps the best situation. Also, CD had become ill with asthma and had to drop out of high school really very early in ninth grade. But Harold found out that CD had married and with her husband had moved to the Southwest for a better climate for her illness. Her husband was well employed. They had a home. They had two children. Harold tested their intelligence, and they were normal children.
CD's children were normal children. Yes.
And that's right.
And now BD.
And BD, when Harold went to see BD's mother, she told him that her love for BD was not like any other love she'd ever had. And if she could adopt another child, she would. She was an orphan herself, and she had been raised in a home, in an institution called a home for the friendless. And she gave BD every bit of encouragement and support. And BD did very well and married someone who worked on the railroad in Iowa. They were very close to her mother and to his parents. They established a family. Her children were normal. And in fact, one of them was superior in intelligence. So they did very well. This was not anything anyone thought would happen.
A note here, because it's a wonderful story. BD and CD still think of each other, and they hope someday they'll meet because they grew up together in Glenwood, and they're like two sisters. Now, case four, Davenport to Glenwood, when adopted, the IQ tested 73. The next time the test was taken, it was 100. The last time it was taken, it was 116, which is genius. And we're told that case four becomes a registered nurse.
That's right.
And are these children are aware that they were adopted. Is that correct? They all knew that? Yes. And she's a registered nurse. They don't interview. So what we're dealing with here is overwhelming evidence of environmentalism. And because it's such a success, whatever happened to eugenics? And when we come back, eugenics disappears, and instead what we have is the foundation of child psychology here in the 21st century. Marilyn Brookwood is the author. The book is The Orphans of Davenport. There's some heartbreaking stories here. We're telling the happy ones so far. Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Marilyn Brookwood is the author of the new book, The Orphans of Davenport, Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. Harold Skills and Maurice Kodak have now proved that their observations from the 1930s are are very much in shape in the 1960s when they revisit these children who were placed in loving homes and develop very quickly, having escaped the idea that they would be trapped in an orphanage forever, as they were called feeble-minded, they were called imbeciles, they were called morons. These were terms used by eugenicists. What happened to the eugenicists? Chiefly what happened is the crimes of the Second War. Chiefly what happened, although there were crimes in all directions, sterilization was routinely practiced in the 1930s and 1940s. People who were isolated or schizophrenic were treated as somebody like criminals. All of this happened. But Marilyn, eugenicists disappeared. People stopped talking about it. Has there been any effort to very carefully go back in places like Stanford or Columbia or the University of Illinois, University of Michigan, and identify those who offered these, or Ohio State University, Marie Skodak's alma mater, and to go back over the eugenicists and identify their prejudices and make it clear that these that the faculty went awry? Do they talk about it today, Marilyn?
No, sadly, there hasn't been that kind of an effort. What happened after the revelations of what the Nazis had done in concentration camps was so horrifying to the nation that eugenics was just not mentioned at all after that period. It's sometimes in the 60s, some of that idea came back. And they call it scientific racism. But really, from the, in the 40s and the 50s, none of that actually surfaced. People were much more focused on recovering from World War II. They, psychologists were much more focused on adults rather than children. And so the ideas that had motivated the people in Iowa, those ideas really shifted tremendously. And the Iowa Station became a very different sort of investigatory organization. and by the 60s, it was no longer really in operation. So things got very, very different in and really, the ideas of Harold and Marie and the other people in Iowa were subsumed by other concerns, and no one really paid attention to them. Harold never even talked about them for reasons of his own, but he didn't. And Marie, who knew all about them, was also very quiet because she was working in schools, and she didn't want to do and wasn't really able to do research any longer.
Let's speak of, because we're talking to people who will take up your investigations, Marilyn, there's a lot of work to be done. Where are the papers of Marie Skodak and Harold Skeels today?
Harold gave his papers to Marie when he discovered that the University of Iowa had gotten rid of, or in a house, what they called a house cleaning, had destroyed a lot of his work. He gave what was left to Marie. The university did that because it was embarrassed by Harold's work and the Iowa Station's work, which so challenged the current ideas. The people at the University of Iowa felt that they had harmed the university with these radical ideas of theirs that children's intelligence actually could change. So today, but Marie was very aware that her papers and what she had left, and that was a lot because she saved a lot, were important. So instead of giving them to the usual place where she had worked, the University of Iowa, she saved them and she gave them to the center, the Cumming Center on the History of Psychology, which is located now at Akron, the University of Akron. And they are all there. In fact, it's amazing to me that no one really looked at them closely before I got there.
There was recognition of Marie Skodak and Harold Skeels in their lifetime from the Kennedys, the Kennedy Award, and that was very important to them. Also important to them were the successes of some of their studies. We mentioned one in particular, Louis Branca. It's Louis Branca, yes? Who became an administrator, and he flew airplanes. And Harold sent him the award that he has from the Kennedys right before Harold's death.
So Lou Branca was the one orphan that I was able to meet because the other orphans' names had been redacted by the archive. And they allowed me to talk with Louis and then know his name because he had been publicly acknowledged as one of the orphans. And he himself talked with people about what it had been like to be in those institutions. And so I got to know Lou and the Maurice Godak and Harold both admired him and knew what he had done with his life, which was similar to what the other orphans had done. And he became an academic and he worked at the University of Minnesota for some years. So this was someone who had been identified as needing to be in an institution for retarded children when he was little. If it hadn't been for Harold, he would not have survived as the person he became.
Brain science is now one of the frontiers of the 21st century. And from my reading of brain science, it's entirely supportive of the revelations at the Iowa station. Do the best of the brain scientific labs, do they acknowledge the scale of this success, the accidental success that is now important part of our child rearing? Is it acknowledged, Marilyn?
Well, you know, scientists are very busy people. The person who I've spoken to the most about it is Charles Nelson, who has done the work on the Romanian orphans, and he does acknowledge it. But, you know, these scientists at Iowa didn't have anything like the equipment that other people have. The other thing they didn't have was, while they used control groups, and Iowa people did use control groups when they did their studies. Most psychologists didn't use control groups. But today, you couldn't do a study like this without using a control group. So the Romanian studies, which do use control groups, have a lot of prestige, and they should have, because they really are the first randomized control studies of orphans who were adopted and show the difference between what it means to be adopted and what it means to grow up in a neglectful institution.
Marilyn, my last question is, have you heard from the University of Iowa since you published your book? I mean, it's a tribute to the genius of Iowa in the 1930s. Are they up to date on their own success?
I haven't heard from them. The person I have heard from is the head of the archive at the Cummings Archive, who's retired now, but who wrote me a wonderful congratulatory letter recently about this research. And he's someone who is a historian of science, and he understood when I came there to do my research how important it was.
One final detail. Maurice Godak, what a heroine. Born Lorain, Ohio. She lived to 90 years old. She wrote of all of their successes. She was the daughter of Hungarian immigrants, as I recall. And the detail that you provide, Marilyn, is wonderful. She wanted to be a metallurgist and a chemist when she went to Ohio State with very little money because her father dreamed of mining silver in South America. I regret we don't have her here to congratulate her on her imagination.
I often think if I could have dinner with any one of these people, it would be Marie.
Marie Skodak, Ohio State University was her alma mater. And thanks to an accidental correspondence with Harold Skeels, history was made. The Orphans of Davenport, Eugenics, the Great Depression, and the War Over Children's Intelligence. Marilyn Brookwood is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.